especially for Wales and also for the southwest of England and the south coast, with gusts 70, perhaps 80 miles an hour. Huge waves will crash up on the shores of southwest England with a risk of coastal flooding again, particularly from Cornwall to Dorset. Plenty of heavy showers moving across the country through the day, interspersed with sunny spells. For Thursday and Friday, sunshine and showers heaviest in the west. Saturday, the next deep area of low pressure moves in, bringing wet and windy weather.
Many thanks, Stav. Now to our book of the week. The broadcaster and journalist Sally Magnusson reads the moving account of her mother Mamie Baird's long struggle with dementia. A pioneering female journalist, Mamie was known for her love of words and of life. She went on to marry the broadcaster and writer Magnus Magnusson, and together they had five children. Sally's book is her attempt to keep hold of her mother as her personality changed shape, and is a heart-rending portrait of what it is really like to lose a loved one, day by day.
Memories go, as you know better than anyone, Mum. And there are some I badly want to hold fast. It's as if I have to catch you now. As if by the time I see you again tomorrow, it may all have changed. As indeed there is every chance it will. Things I love about you. Your delight in the mad whirl of snow. Your unquenchable enthusiasm for sliding down banisters. "That's how I'd like to go down these stairs," you murmured the other day, eyeing the one outside your bedroom with alarming intent. "You're 83, Mum," I said. "You broke your hip 4 weeks ago." You looked at it longingly all the same. I like to imagine that same gleam in your eye just before you vaulted a dustbin on Buchanan Street in Glasgow on the way to your first interview with the Sunday Post. "For goodness sake, Mamie," your mother had sighed when you landed. "Try to act like a lady." Those husky harmonies layering every song you've ever sung, and the way when everything else is slipping away, every skill, every talent, you still want to sing. Your wit, even in your foggiest moments, it flashes through just often enough to remind us how sharp you were, how dry, how you used to make audiences cry with laughter. The way you stroke my hair when I'm kneeling to take your socks off. You do it apologetically almost, as if to say you shouldn't be doing this. The tenderness more than makes up for your having lately introduced me to my sister with the words, "Now, do you two know each other?" Things I miss about you. The way you would offer stories of your life to the most casual stranger on a bus, train or aeroplane and extract theirs in an instant. The stories themselves, your childhood, your war, those adventures on the newspaper beat you never tired of recounting, your spontaneous serenading of the Queen at a posh banquet you graced with my father, which led to the whole staid Edinburgh table joining in to bellow, "Will you no come back again?" to an astonished monarch. So many stories. You still try to tell them, but now they wander far and wide in search of a lost punchline. Things I observe with dread. Empty eyes, grim mouth, vacant expression, stony face. Aggressive sniping at the twin sister whose mind has remained lively while yours has not. This is the worst thing, the very worst thing of all. If dementia care were a country, it would be the world's 18th largest economy, somewhere between Turkey and Indonesia. As a company measured by annual revenue, it would be the world's largest. There are thought to be 44 million people with it across the world, with an extra 7.7 million cases predicted each year. The World Health Organization estimates one new case every 4 seconds, and thinks the global figure is likely to double every 20 years. This is a disease that respects neither geography, ethnicity, class, nor gender. You, my darling mother, are unique in all sorts of ways, but not in succumbing to this disease. Not by a long way. The cost of care is astronomical. Looking after people with the various symptoms of dementia is already costing 1% of global GDP. In the UK, the figure is over £23 billion, more than the cost of care for stroke, heart disease and cancer combined. Most of us will be touched by dementia in one way or another, either as relatives, friends, or the one in three over the age of 65 who will eventually die with it ourselves. Dearest mother, as I watch your sparky intellect flounder and your very identity dissolve before my eyes, I'm beginning to conclude that dementia holds a dagger to the heart of Western morality. It confronts us with profound philosophical as well as scientific questions about what it is to be human. It compels us to ask whether we have any right to call ourselves a civilized society at all. More than any other modern ailment, we really are all in this together. Tobermory on the Isle of Mull has a flamboyant air in the sunshine. Colourful buildings elbow each other jauntily along the main street. The bay shimmers placidly below us. It's the summer of 1999, and you and I are thinking about cows. The story of the heroic cow that saved the ancestral croft was passed down from your grandmother, the doughty Annie McKechnie. Her father James had a rented croft in Ardmore, a few miles north of Tobermory, where he eked a chancy living from cattle and crops. After he died, so the story goes, the family struggled on with little except one cow to provide milk and butter, and, if they were lucky, a youngster that could be sold at market. The cow was the crofter's lifeline, but that also made it vulnerable. Landowners looking for ways to force indigent tenants off the land to make way for sheep found that confiscating the cow often did the trick. The day came when it was our family's turn to lose their cow, you'd told me years earlier. It was taken from them, along with other cows from neighbouring crofts, and put in an island off Tobermory known as Calve Island. Lo and behold, you said, to their amazement, that cow managed to swim right across the Sound of Mull again and walk back to the family croft. From the moment I heard the story, I wanted to follow it up. In the months before our trip to Mull, I chased genealogical leads, fired off obscure questions to weary librarians, and pored over musty records. I couldn't wait to tell you what I had found. But something was wrong. You ought to have been thrilled, but you weren't engaging with my research. Given how often you had regaled me with the exploits of the homesick cow, I was puzzled and even a little hurt to find you so detached. Everyone notices the onset of dementia in a loved one differently. The discovery of house keys in the oven, perhaps, the repeated disappearance of spectacles, a meeting missed, an easy word lost. Common in ageing, of course, normal in all sorts of stressed lives, is only in hindsight that these incidents acquire a more sinister meaning. I don't recall any house key incidents, and you'd been faithfully losing your glasses since the day you acquired your first pair in your early 50s, so nothing new there. What I was starting to notice was a mislaying, not of spectacles, but of curiosity. A subtle withdrawing of interest and insecurity with detail I hadn't recognised before. Look, I persevered, I've found your great-grandparents. That's interesting, you said politely, sounding as if it wasn't really. This was baffling. However, I did persuade you to join me on an excursion to see the place for ourselves. We set out by car from Glasgow on a sun-drenched August day, taking my 9-year-old daughter Annalisa along too. You responded at once to the adventure. You sang us along Loch Lomond and up the winding road to Oban. This was more like it. You, sparky and engaged and rearing for whatever lay ahead. Nothing, surely, was amiss at all. But something happened on Mull. Something that makes me look back on that brief excursion as both a glorious high point of normality, you still the daring, sharp-witted, loquacious companion of old, and also the shadowy beginning of something new. Most of our time on the island was idyllic, full of walks and songs, steaming bags of chips and easy conversation. But there was one incident that I now place beside the peculiar absence of curiosity as marking the beginning of the journey we've been on ever since. I was in bed in the room I was sharing with Annalisa in the guest house, reading, when there was a knock at the door. You were standing there, wearing nothing but a short pyjama jacket and, thank goodness, a pair of knickers. You were laughing. You explained that you'd got out of bed in your room up the stairs to go to the toilet along the corridor and your bedroom door had slammed shut behind you. I snorted with laughter too and hustled you inside. Annalisa woke up and grinned sleepily at another of Grandma's famous scrapes. Yet, something felt odd about this latest escapade. Why were you not wearing your pyjama trousers in a strange house where you might meet the owners or another guest on your way? You joined us in our room for the rest of the night, and I thought little of it at the time beyond a twinge of, well, what? Alarm is too strong. Unease, maybe? Disquiet? There was just something about the blank look you gave me when I interrogated you about the absence of half your pyjamas that is now horribly familiar. Of course, there must have been dozens of other telltale signs before, if I had only registered them. Each of us has 100 billion neurons in our brain, and each of them can have up to 100,000 thread-like connections. I'm looking into a microscope where the nerve cells and the threads running between them look like a tangle of Christmas lights. Dr. Frank Gunn-Moore, St. Andrews University Professor of Molecular Neurobiology, is trying to explain to me why the brain is by far and away the most complex entity we know of in the universe. In a living brain, each of the neurons would be carrying an electrical signal to other neurons, and on these signals depend all our memories, thoughts, and feelings. The point where the signals make contact is known as the synapse. When a charge reaches a synapse, it triggers the release of a tiny burst of chemicals called neurotransmitters, which travel across the synapse, carrying the signals to other cells. Alzheimer's disease disrupts both the way electrical charges travel within cells and the activity of the neurotransmitters. Under a microscope, it looks as if someone has taken a hammer and pliers to my pretty Christmas lights. I've sought this leading neurobiologist out to help me imagine what might have been going on inside your own head that summer, when vagueness over detail was starting to blunt your usually sharp grasp of facts, and you were forgetting to put on your pyjamas. What tends to happen in Alzheimer's disease, he says, is that you lose the short-term memory. The smaller, shorter synapses seem to be the ones being affected first. And at later stages, the longer-term memory goes as well. All the connections you're seeing there start to go. He watches as I peer through the microscope, unable to tear my eyes away from those cells of light and the glittering fragility of their golden threads. You ask me what memory is, he says to my bent head. Well, it can be defined in many ways, but for me, that's it, there, right there. You're looking at the place where memories go.
Tomorrow, Sally Magnusson continues reading her memoir, Where Memories Go. It was abridged by Sarah Davies and produced by Justine Willett. The shipping forecast lurks, and before that, sailing by. sailing by. And so to the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Tuesday, the 4th of February. There are